Cigarette. Hello and welcome to Different Bits. Today, joining us in the studio is Scott Draves, aka Spot, a local Bay Area artist and programmer. He's the creator of the Fractal Flame algorithm, the Bomb visual musical instrument, and the Electric Sheep distributed screensaver. All of Draves' software artworks are released as open source and distributed for free on the internet. So, Scott, if you could start by introducing yourself and giving us a little background on who you are.
Hi Heather, thank you very much. Like you said, I'm Spot, and let's see my background. I come from the computer world. I've been programming computers pretty much all my life, and I consider myself a computer person. And the kind of programming that I like to do is visual programming. I like to write programs that draw pretty pictures. And in particular, abstract pictures, ones that I just kind of get lost in. I like to stare at the screen and kind of ultimately enter a trance state. And that's the source of my art, is that mental state.
So maybe we should start by discussing your most well-known project, Electric Sheep. Could you
Okay.
just explain what it is?
Sure. So Electric Sheep has been around for, what, 5 years now? Is it 2005? So it started back in 99, and it has its roots, though, in an older algorithm. So it's even older than that. But anyway, what it is a distributed screensaver. And so that means it's a screensaver. So it's a thing, you just download it and install it on your PC or your Mac. And when you're not using your computer, it comes on and it does a little show for you. And I call it a distributed screensaver because all the computers that are running the software are actually communicating with each other. And they create these animations collaboratively. They render them and share the results. And so everybody who's running the software sees the same thing. So it's a little bit like a station that you tune into. And it was inspired by a screensaver called SETI at Home, which is pretty well known at this point. And that's a project from Berkeley, where it's distributed. It's the same idea of it's a screensaver that is communicating over the internet, but in that case, it's searching through radio telescope data for this signal from an alien civilization. And Electric Sheep has sort of turns that idea on its head, and instead of searching for the aliens, it uses all those computers in order to bring alien life forms to life, to sort of render them into existence. And so what it really is it takes all the computers running the screensaver, and it combines them together into like a supercomputer, and then tries to create an artificial organism, sort of artificial life in that sort of virtual compute environment.
And it creates these fractal flames, right?
That's right.
Could you explain what the fractal flames are?
Sure. It's hard. Of course, it's hard to explain what something looks like, a picture, and you just have to look at them. But what they are is, well, they're fractals, which means, and they're images, they're abstract, but they're created by a mathematical equation. And the equation is actually very simple to write down. It's a recursive equation. So these fractals are defined in terms of themselves, and that's sort of like what gives them their natural appearance. So the characteristic of a fractal is, when you zoom into it, if you look at it closely, it looks the same as the whole picture. So no matter how closely you zoom, there'll always be more sort of structure and detail, and that's in contrast to objects that we create with sort of normal engineering, where if you zoom into a table, like, you'll start out seeing the edge of the table, but once you eventually it will turn into just a line, and you stop having you stop having fun. But with a fractal, no matter how much you zoom in, there's still more to see. And that's actually, the zooming thing is not that important to the electric sheep, because electric sheep doesn't zoom in. But that is sort of the origin. That's sort of like what fractals are. So they are these sort of like nonlinear objects. And they're an easy way. What's cool about them is they have a lot of visual complexity. There's like detail all over the screen. But they're created by, they're sort of specified by this equation, which has a pretty small description. And it's basically a string of numbers, all these parameters that tell the equation exactly what it's doing. And so in the case of electric sheep, this string of numbers is really a genetic code. So, and that's part of why the name electric sheep means, you know, so each sheep, each fractal has a string of numbers, it has a genetic code. And so the software takes the genetic code and the genotype and renders it. It creates the animation, which is the phenotype, which is the sheep, which is what you actually see swirling around on the on your screen.
How many possible genotypes are there with your system?
Well, it's a high dimensional space, so, and it keeps getting higher. As I think, more or less, it's 150 dimensions right now, and each of those dimensions is a floating point number. So it could have a value, say, between -1 and 1, continuously variable. Mm-hmm. So what that means is that the total number is, you know, astronomical, but it's effectively infinite. But there's, but that doesn't mean, but two if even two genomes might result in images that actually look very much alike. Okay. So there is maybe there's like a finite variety of images that it can produce, but it's a very large variety. I mean, I've been using the software for like 15 years now, and I'm still surprised and amazed by the images that come out of it. There seem to be an infinite number of categories of mm-hmm. shapes. Apparently, I mean, maybe someday we'll stop discovering them, but then I'll just change the algorithm.
And there are family resemblances and such between.
Yeah, so that's
closely related organisms.
That's right. So I didn't explain the whole electric sheep concept yet. So part of the idea, part of the point of the metaphor of the genome is, well, what do genes do? They have sex, and so that's what the sheep do. And so the genomes aren't picked at random. They're picked according to a genetic algorithm. So it's the sheep that are most beautiful, more or less, live longer and reproduce. And so over time, and that's like the sort of the, according to the way evolution works, you know, survival of the fittest, over time the sheep learn to become more beautiful and they learn to sort of please their audience. And now, how does the computer or how does the system know like what's beautiful? Mm-hmm. And well, that's a really hard question to answer. Like, you know, beauty is so abstract, and we have almost pretty much no idea how to write an equation to quantify it exactly. So what I did was I left that to the users. So anybody who's running the software, if you're watching it and you like what you see on the screen, you can just hit the up arrow key and say, basically vote, say, yes, I like this one. And all those votes, which come from the whole audience, are collated and tabulated by the server and distilled into ratings. And so, and then those ratings are what drive the evolutionary algorithm. So the sheep with the highest ratings, basically whoever gets the most votes, gets to reproduce.
Have you found that people...
So it's sort of a strange combination between sexuality and politics on the computer.
Have you found that people participate? That they do interact often, voting and that kind of thing?
Oh, yeah. So the software has had enough time to sort of diffuse through online culture. And there are many levels of participation. So the first level is just download the software and run it. And at that point, you're already participating because your computer is contributing energy, you know, rendering time. And then the next level of participation would be voting. So then you're contributing your aesthetic judgment to help guide the evolution of the flock. And there's higher levels too. Some people, you know, they can send me suggestions, or they can, because it's all open source, people get inspired, they can actually get into the code and send me improvements. And that actually is a substantial amount, and an increasing amount of that is sort of happening. And a third way that people can get involved is by using this software called Apophysis, which is like a genetic design program. So that's a regular piece of software, like with a GUI with, you know, windows and lots of little buttons and little boxes where you type in numbers and sliders and stuff. Unfortunately, it only runs on Windows. We're working on a portable version. But anyway, with this software, you can design a sheep, sort of like a genetic designer. And when you've got like a nice picture on your screen, you basically click a button and it gets sent into the flock. It gets uploaded to the server and then rendered by all of the machines and eventually, you know, seen by the whole audience. So there's lots of different ways for people to participate. And I mean, I can give you a few numbers. So I guess typically I've been getting about 100 votes per day, and maybe a dozen posted genomes.
Wow.
And I would say there's about 10,000 sort of users on a per day. So there's about 10,000 different computers connect to the server to download sheep on any given day.
And how have you seen the sheep sort of evolving over time? Do you notice patterns?
I notice, well, there's definitely sort of trends or fashion or something like that, because, you know, somebody comes up with an idea or something new appears, and then it gets a lot of, you know, people think, wow, that's cool, that's new, and so it gets a lot of votes, and then it starts reproducing, and it you know, its children are variations on it. Sometimes only slight variations, and sometimes quite different, but usually, like you said, there's a family resemblance. You know, you can look at the two parents and sort of say, oh yeah, like it's got the, you know, the sort of the squiggly thing from its parent, this parent, and it's got like, you know, that's sort of color from the other parent or something like that. Anyway, so there'll be a trend, like suddenly, you know, big circles or big, you know, blue spirals will suddenly be all over the place. But eventually people get bored of blue spirals and they stop getting the votes, and so they peter out, and it's replaced by something else. I would be interested to say there's a deeper question, which is, you know, is there some grand trend? Like, that's kind of something that happens on a sort of week-to-week basis. But it's a more interesting question of, like, you know, what about the big picture? Yeah. And I couldn't say I've identified any, but I will
no
say...
No brains yet?
The software keeps changing. That's one of the biggest variables. So over the large time scale, the genetic code itself gets reprogrammed, and so the sort of the space of possibilities changes. And that's an overriding determinant. But at the level below that, we have some theories, and I've only recently started. When I say recently, I guess I now mean a year ago. Yeah, starting about a year ago, I only started collecting the data a year ago. So before then, I really had no idea what sheep were popular, and I didn't keep the family histories, like the lineages, nothing. So, and I've only started doing that recently, and we're starting to analyze it, and there's a lot to be learned from it. It's going to turn into some papers, and I'm finding some collaborators, other people who have sort of thought about, for example, the question we had before, which is, well, how do you quantify beauty? Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting problem, and it's not necessarily completely impossible. Like, maybe you can say something. Maybe you can find something quantifiable that correlates with what we humans sort of agree on what beauty is. Of course, no two people ever really even agree on beauty. So how can we expect, you know, a computer program which gets it right?
Right.
It's sort of an unreasonable test. But finding something that correlates is an achievable goal, and it's a whole field of research. There's entire conferences devoted to this, and so there are people who have thought about it a lot. And those people are now coming to Electric Sheep saying, well, here's like thousands of data points that now we can run through our models and maybe we can find some conclusions.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, and so they have a lot more expertise and ideas about this than I do. And
yeah, I was going to ask actually about your reasoning for choosing fractal images and if that was related to, I know that there's been work done at least recently on dimensionality of fractals and beauty and complexity in painting and that kind of stuff.
Tell me about that.
I'm trying to remember now. It just popped into my head while you were speaking. I remember an article that was possibly in Scientific American. Right.
It was just forwarded to me.
Oh, really?
Yes, by these what people I'm sort of referring to. So I think you're ahead of me.
There's also a book called, I believe it's called Art and Complexity, that came out later that year, I believe. And they had a number of, a good portion of the book was related to that idea.
Okay.
See if I can get you that for all of you, and including our audience, later. And I would like to just mention that we are live in the studio, and if anyone listening would like to call in to ask Scott a question, the phone number is area code 415-864-1006. So for you, choosing the fractals was more just your personal aesthetic.
Well, it sort of was a reverse decision. So the way Electric Sheep was created back in 99, it was not that long after we had SETI at Home was created. And mm-hmm. so that was an idea that was in the air.
Right.
And I already had an existing fractal algorithm that actually dates back to 92. And that had been turned into an After Effects plugin, and that was the Fractal Flame algorithm. Uh-huh. And it was in After Effects, which is this video editing software. And it was open source, so people were using it to make movies, and somebody made a movie and put it on a videotape and sent it to me, and it was like, it was pretty cool. I was very impressed. It was better than anything I had done with the software, and it was part of what was impressive about it was like 10 minutes long, and it must have taken this person like months of computer time to render the animation, because this software is not fast, I admit. And I mean, this was a long time ago, and computers were, of course,
even slower.
Yeah, slower. So I was like, wow, you know, if you had, you know, we looked at this videotape and SETI at Home at the same time and said, well, let's just put these two things together and use the distributed, you know, internet screensaver idea in order to solve the problem of creating these animations, you know, that are very expensive. And then that just sort of combined really naturally with the idea of the evolution. And then ever since then, it's just sort of been growing and accumulating.
How does the plugin work? Is it still something that is used, or?
Yeah. It's outdated now because the Fractal Flame algorithm, I've improved it a lot since the plugin was made. Mm-hmm. And I didn't do the plugin. The plugin was sort of made out of my engine.
Right.
And so it's up to somebody else to update it. And it hasn't happened. But anyway, it's still used quite a bit, and I see it in, like, you know, movies and TV commercials all the time. So it's, anybody can download it. It's been distributed in, like, you know, Adobe's, they hand out a CD-ROM with After Effects of, like, you know, sort of like commercial samples, and most of them are like sort of teasers for other products that mm-hmm. you can then buy. But in this case, of course, it's the whole deal. So, but the plugin is quite tricky because its interface is very bad. It doesn't have a good design interface, and it's very slow. It's hard to make it do good stuff, and so it's probably, the people who do actually use it are probably pretty hardcore, you know.
So the guy who sent you the video was really,
yeah, he
really
was
trying.
Yeah, I was impressed.
I'm curious. You know, the software connects all of these unknown users together in this joined computational effort. I'm sort of curious what this significance of that cooperative connection is for you, if it is for you.
Oh yeah, totally. So there's a lot of sort of, I don't know, philosophy, or maybe you might even say politics, sort of behind the architecture. And, you know, I mean, the idea, and that's also part of, you know, that's also why I do open source. I mean, because I'm trying to demonstrate that, you know, you don't have to have anyone in control in order to have, you know, cooperation, in order for things to work, in order mm-hmm. to create beauty. And so I'm trying to just sort of, and that's part of also why, like, you know, I'm into the open source thing, because, you know, I don't think, you know, that kind of artificial scarcity, which is represented by things like, I don't know, limited editions, mm-hmm. You know, just isn't necessary. And so I want to sort of provide a counterexample and say that, you know, this.
You know. We'll come back to the open source movement a little later
in
the program. So moving forward a little bit, or possibly backwards, I'm not sure about chronology, actually. Could you tell us about BOM?
Sure. So BOM is a, it's basically older. It was mostly in the sort of 94 to 97 time frame. Or maybe it was before that. Maybe it was 93 to 97. But it was, it's a, what I call a visual musical instrument. And so that means it's a piece of software, and you can play it kind of like you would play a trumpet or a piano or the bongos. Maybe, probably the better metaphor. And but instead of producing music, it produces visuals. So basically graphics. And let's see, and it also uses these sort of complex systems, things like, you know, fractals and cellular automata, in order to sort of amplify the information content of your keystrokes, sort of like the buttons that you push and of your mouse movements. It sort of amplifies that sort of information into some sort of organic graphics that are kind of moving with your keystrokes and also moving with the audio input. So it could take the line in, the microphone, and sort of respond to the music. So it was a little bit like, you know, right now we've got iTunes and Winamp and all these sort of the music visualization genre has really exploded now. And this was sort of it was related. It was a little different, because it could respond to music, and I had what I called automatic mode, where it sort of drove itself. But it was really intended to be sort of performed live, to have sort of a human in the loop, which the Winamp kind of iTunes things don't. So it was a little different, but it was related, and it turned into what was basically a VJ sort of mm-hmm. tool. so that you could then plug the software into a, you know, a projector, and it could like do something, you know, behind the band or behind the DJ. And that's when the automatic mode was really handy, because you could just set it on automatic and then go and enjoy the party yourself instead of being tied down to the your computer or your mixing board or whatever.
So maybe you could explain a little bit more technically sort of how it, you mentioned like cellular automata and artificial life stuff. Maybe a little more technical explanation.
Of what like cellular automata is?
Or just of how BOM as a, creative process takes the user input and what it does. With that?
Okay. Let's see. Well, it would... it has a whole lot of difference. It's mostly a cellular automata-based program. So every pixel on the screen is being sort of recomputed on every single frame. And so, again, this was something that was written back, you know, in 94, and it was done on, like, a 486 laptop. And so, and it was part of what was really sort of unique about it was that it really did, you know, compute the whole screen, every frames. And it was pretty fast. So it was doing stuff in real time, which was unusual back then. And, but the problem with cellular automata, which of course was a really well-known effect or really well-known technique at that time, was that they usually don't look that beautiful. You know, there's kind of, they're like black and white, you know, like everyone knows the Game of Life, invented by John Conway. And, you know, it kind of does these little squares move around in these sometimes fascinating patterns. And it has a certain aesthetic appeal, but it's not beautiful. It's not something you would really, you know, expect to find on like a painting in somebody's wall. So what I did was I took that basic technique and then just like added a lot of jazz. So instead of one bit per pixel, it has like 32 bits per pixel, and it does like multiple cellular automata algorithms simultaneously that then interact with each other. Or it does things like diffusion, so you can the square, like it can run a cellular automaton, but then have the little squares emit heat, which then like diffuses through the other squares. And so then you get, and then like you can do, and then with underflow or something to make it just more fancy. And then, and then like adding color and, you know, multiple layers. And oh yeah, the other problem with cellular automata is that they have a certain homogeneous texture. So if you look at them, like a whole screen of them, it's sort of like, if you look at it from a distance, it kind of turns into just gray. You know, there's no large scale features. And so in order to get around that, you know, but large scale features look good. You know, you want to see something, some object on the screen. And a cellular automaton, you just see like lots of little tinglies. So I did things like run one layer of cellular automata at sort of slowly, but with big squares, you know what I mean? So it was like low resolution squares. And then another cellular automaton, like faster with smaller squares. And so, and then they're interacting, so one cellular automata could affect the other one. But that way, that the one layer provides like the big features, and another layer provides the detail, and so together they can sort of add up to a much more organic looking picture, and something that doesn't look like it came out of a math textbook, like cellular automata normally do.
And as far as the user interaction, that sort of would set up the initial conditions for the automata?
It controls the mode. So there's lots of different rules. So, you know, like one of them is diffusion and one of them is life and one of them is, you know, and they're all bound to different keys on the keyboard. And so what you can just hit the different keys on the keyboard to switch the rules. And so what you control is sort of like the overall texture or the overall effect of what's happening on the screen. There's also, of course, then there was also the microphone, which was like making things move. And then there's also actually the mouse, where you can like draw into the frame buffer with the mouse. So you could sort of create little trails or pictures or sort of things moving around.
Are you still working on this project, or is this one kind of complete?
No, it's I don't do anything to it. It just kind of people still download it, people still run it, but I'm pretty much, and you know, there's things I would love to do to it, and people keep asking me to do things to it, but I have to limit. I only have a limited amount of time, and I'm spending it on Electric Sheep right now.
Okay, I was going to ask actually what your sort of current focus was and what you were looking towards the future, what you were looking to do.
Well, yeah, it's all Electric Sheep all the time. It has. I'm really.
It's taken over your life.
Yeah, it has, and I'm not unhappy either. It's a good deal, but there's. It's come a long way from when it started, and really, I did the first version in 2 weeks of engineering time.
Wow.
And it was actually, you know, a fully functional client server that did Electric Sheep, but it was missing so much, you know, and it took several years before it actually began to achieve its potential. And now it's actually exceeded my initial vision for it, and it does a lot more than I ever really thought it would or could. But I've also realized I have a long way to go, and there's a lot more. So there's all kinds of stuff remaining to do. Like, right now I'm involved in, well, improving. Right now I have a lot of just performance engineering to do, so in the server, because it's attracted a lot of users. Mm-hmm. And part of the original idea and part of the concept is that it's this, I think of the project as like an attention, like this vortex that sort of attracts attention. And the more you look at things, sort of the more you see. And so if you study an idea, you start to see more, these details within that idea start to appear. And that's sort of the way Electric Sheep works. You know, the more people who run it, then the better it looks. And if nobody were running it, then there would be nothing to see. So, and the development of the software sort of follows the same sort of snowball kind of course. Like, the more people who work on it, the better it gets, and then that attracts more attention and more developers. And so it's got this kind of, I feel like there's like a star system that's kind of accreting out of dust originally, you know, and first there gets to be like a warm lump in the center, and eventually, you know, it attracts enough mass that it ignites, and it becomes like an independent star, and it has like a life and energy of its own. And so right now I still have to put in my energy and my life to sort of keep it going.
Mm-hmm.
If I died tomorrow, then I think Electric Sheep would also die. Oh, yeah, terrible thought. But and I don't want that responsibility.
Right.
So
you want to let it free?
Yeah. And so I need to. And more or less, the problem is right now is it still has, even though there's a lot of the project is distributed. So all those clients, all those computers are doing the work of rendering.
Mm-hmm.
And all the audience is doing the work of voting, so of providing the aesthetic fitness function. There's still things that there's still a central server, and the central server is a bottleneck, and it's also has that sort of administrative problem. Like if it goes away, you know, if I get either sued, and I've actually, you know, I've received it's entirely possible. Or, you know, if I just run out of money and decide I can't, and time, and decide I can't do this, then it would stop.
And if you get sued, it's entirely possible, you said?
Yes, because of the MPEG licensing authority, the people who control the video compression standards require licenses for this and that, and so there are patents in the MPEG algorithm, and because Electric Sheep uses MPEG, it is, well, I'll just say I got a letter from them that said that I should pay them royalties, and I ignored it, and I haven't heard back from them. So, I mean, really, you know, I have no money, and this right. is this is not a commercial enterprise, and, you know, there's a million people that they're going to they should sue before they sue me, you know.
Well, let's hope so.
Yeah, but, you know, then again, it's you know, it's Hollywood lawyers, and so rationality isn't necessarily on their agenda.
Hmm.
Who knows? It's not I'm not really worried about it, but it's possible. Who knows? But really what I want to do is eliminate the server and make the algorithm totally distributed, and then it can't be stopped.
That definitely sounds exciting. So how would it work differently then if it was completely distributed in terms of sort of the user?
Well, the user from the user's perspective, hopefully it would be identical.
Mm-hmm.
And so it would be transparent. You would still just download and install this little
mm-hmm.
screensaver, and then if you like what you see, you hit the up arrow key. I mean, it's dirt simple, and that shouldn't change. But the mechanism to make it work would be much more complicated. And so right now, it's kind of has this, it's like a P2P network in that the clients are actually contributing, they're doing useful work, but it's not completely distributed. And so what I'd like to, you know, you've probably know this software called BitTorrent,
mm-hmm.
which is a peer-to-peer software for downloading files. And so it accelerates downloads. And if I incorporate BitTorrent into Electric Sheep, then the sort of downloading bandwidth can be shared among all the clients. Because right now, all the clients are downloading MPEGs from my server, and it's a bottleneck in the system.
I'm wondering if you would be interested in maybe talking a little bit more about the whole idea of an aesthetic selection system.
Uh-huh.
Or aesthetic fitness.
Aesthetic fitness? can you be more specific?
I was wondering if you'd want to talk about the history of the idea and sort of what it means to you, why you chose to use a aesthetic selection mechanism in your project, maybe.
Well,
as opposed to just generating images, let's say, from a...
Well, I mean, everyone likes pretty things, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to make a pretty thing. That's... needs almost no explanation. As far as the history of the idea, well, I think aesthetic selection has a lot of history. I think we're all familiar with it. But in the computer world, as far as like implementing it in software and then using it, you know, for evolution or using it to drive evolution, that is a pretty recent idea. And there's a couple of, I mean, I guess it's probably about 15 to 18 years ago. There were several people who sort of started to do it. Richard Dawkins is probably the most famous one. I mean, he wrote a book called The Blind Watchmaker, which was about evolution. And he had these things called biomorphs and the software that you could run on your PC where you could basically, it drew these little creatures that looked like little stick figures, and you picked the ones that it would then breed. It wasn't very pretty. So I'm not sure it really qualifies for aesthetic selection or aesthetic evolution, but it was...
User interactive.
Yes, it was user interactive. Interactive evolution, where you're user-directed evolution. And then it was a couple years later that two people... most successfully, this guy, Carl Sims, who took that same idea, but instead of doing it with these little stick figures, he did it with full-color, high-resolution, abstract images.
Mm-hmm.
And he it was a huge success. It was pretty much blew minds all over the world, and including mine. So And he was able to do this partly because he worked for a supercomputer company called Thinking Machines. That was, and so he had access to this huge, you know, AI supercomputer, and he could evolve these beautiful images. And he was, and so that he is definitely also part of the inspiration for the whole project. So it's sort of like a cross between SETI at Home and Carl Sims and the fractal algorithm, and just combine those three things to come out with Electric Sheep.
In your explanation of Baum, you say that the essential feature of life is creative expansion, which I thought was an interesting statement. I'm wondering if you'd want to talk about that a little bit.
Oh, geez.
Creative expansion.
My, I wrote that how many years ago?
Just reading through your website. You don't have to. I won't hold you to ideas from 6 years ago.
I'll try to elaborate on it, but
Later in the paper, you also say that life, consciousness, and intelligence are not an accident. Organization is the rule, not the exception. So maybe, I don't know. Bring those together.
It's something I'm still down with, but I guess expansion. So there's this part of the. What I was really into when I wrote that stuff, and I still am into, is this notion of extropy, which is the sort of the opposite of entropy. And entropy is something from physics that we all learn in high school that says, you know, the world is basically, or any closed system is kind of winding down, and over time, organization will decay, and eventually you're going to end up with mush. And so, you know, if you apply that to the whole universe, you can say, well, the universe is headed towards, you know, mush. But then there's this contradiction, which says, well, if you look at, you know, life here on Earth, you sort of see the opposite thing. You know, we're not headed towards mush. You know, we started out with what's called, you know, the primordial ooze. We started out in mush.
Mush.
And then, you know, since then we've been evolving. You know, we started out with, you know, one-celled creatures, and then plants and animals and mammals and eventually people and civilization and whatnot. And so I guess that's usually called progress, and that starts to be a politically loaded term these days. But I don't think that the going from ooze to, you know, civilization is that controversial.
It's certainly change over time.
Yeah, and it's good. Come on, admit it. Do you want to be ooze?
Well, I don't know.
In particular, when I say it's not an accident, it's actually I'm contradicting Stephen Jay Gould, who has this theory that he says that intelligence, and in particular our intelligence, mm-hmm. is an accident, and there is no arrow to evolution, and there is no such thing as progress. And this is the party line of postmodern cultural theory. And I'm reacting a little against that and saying, you know, I think that intelligence is not accidental. I think, you know, that it's part of, I think that we're going somewhere. And
do you have any idea where?
The mothership.
Increasing organization? Change?
Yeah, I mean, essentially it's a optimistic theory. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm not saying that all change is good, and I'm not saying that, you know, people don't make mistakes and bad things don't happen, but I don't think that it's necessarily true that good will triumph over evil. I think that, you know, that's an eternal struggle. But something is going on.
So you do believe in progress. Well, that's great. I can't say I've interviewed very many people who probably would say that.
So I know. It's a minority position, and that's why it's something that's worth writing, because I don't want to be a member of the chorus, right? It doesn't make any sense mm-hmm. to repeat that.
That's what struck me about your statement, actually. That's why I wanted to ask you. So how does that relate back to your artwork, then, sort of these ideas?
Well, my artwork is an attempt to manifest, you know, this ideal world. You know, Gandhi says, you know, be the change you want to affect. And mm-hmm. so that's what I'm trying to do. And so I see, you know, I'm sort of fundamentally, you know, like an anarchist kind of thing. Like, I don't think there has to be control in order for things to work out. And so I believe in that sort of order from chaos kind of stuff, and that iteration of simple rules mm-hmm. can create complex things and beautiful things. And, you know, it's also a scientific philosophy. So it's part of this idea of simple rules creating, or, you know, life or mm-hmm. intelligence, is more or less saying ultimately that, you know, it's a materialist theory. It's saying that, you know, you don't need God in order to give us souls. We can make them ourselves. And so...
So is that sort of what attracts you to artificial life?
Yeah. It's an attempt to, you know, really it is exactly what it says. It's an attempt to, you know, to create life. And that's, you know, just right along there with, you know, with Frankenstein and mm-hmm. all the rest of them.
Yeah, we've interviewed a number of artists working in the artificial life.
Actually, yeah, I noticed area. You so just spoke with John McCormack. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
Was he here?
He was not. No, he was in Australia.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
We did speak with John last.
It's interesting because I just was with him 3 weeks ago now mm-hmm. in Switzerland. We were both at a conference on evolutionary algorithms.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And. So we got. Of course, I've been familiar with his work for a long time, mm-hmm. and a fan of his work. And I finally got to meet him, and that was fun. And also other people from all over the world. It was really a fun conference.
Anything new that you gleaned from this conference to share?
I discovered what happens when you plug an American voltage computer into a European Yikes. Outlet and. Turn it on. Let's see.
It's okay if nothing pops into mind. Before we run out of time, I would like to sort of tie this back into the open source movement, if you wanted to talk a little about why you make all your software open source.
Well, I make my software open source because, you know, I don't believe in I don't believe that copyright is a good way of organizing society. You know, I think it's been co-opted by sort of the corporations, and it's become a mechanism of control. And I want to, you know, I don't believe it, and so I try not to participate in the system. Mm-hmm. And it's not completely possible. But, you know, my artwork is one part of my life that I can make that choice. And so I choose open source.
Right on. Well, on that note, I think we'll call it to a close. Is there anything else you wanted to say? Or you have your partner is here also.
Yeah, but no, there is something else I want to say, which I want to plug the DVD.
Please do.
So... This, by the way, is a gift for you. I don't know if you have a copy,
you.
But
I don't.
Now you do. And one of my outlets. So since all the software is free, downloadable from the internet, I do have to make a living like the rest of us. And one way I do that is by selling physical objects, that is DVDs. And so what I do is I take the Electric Sheep, the very best of them, and synchronize them with music and basically turn them into sort of trance electronic music videos. And you can and put them on DVD and sell that. And so this one is called Spotworks, and it's available. If you go to spotworks.com, you can read all about it, and you can order a copy for yourself if you are so inclined. And I guess that's the DVD spiel.
All right, and you're speaking soon, correct?
That's right. I have. Thank you for reminding me. On May 5th, I'm taking part in a conference at Berkeley University. That's called 050505. And if you just type, I guess the easiest way to find it might be to go to my blog, or if you just type that number 050505 into Google, I think their webpage is now the number one hit for it. But it looks like a really interesting conference. There's a whole bunch of artists, sort of art, technology, culture kind of people getting together and doing really quick presentations. So everyone's going to get 15 minutes. And so it's going to be fast-paced and exciting, and the lineup is really good. People from everyone from like Ken Goldberg to Dana Boyd is going to be there. And it's free to the public, but you do have to register in advance. So check it out.
Sounds great. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Heather.
And thank you for listening to Different Bits on Enemy Combatant Radio. We'll see you next week. Thank you.